Chapter 10. The Cult of the Country Boy. Elvis Presley, Andy Griffith, and LBJ's Great Society. I'm a self-confessed raw country boy and guitar-playing fool. Elvis Presley, 1956. Lyndon wasn't upper class at all. Country boy, grown up in the hills. Virginia Foster Dürr, Alabama civil rights activist, 1991. Most will remember the famous photograph of Elvis Presley standing alongside President Richard Nixon in the Oval Office. But why is it forgotten that Presley gained the friendship of Lyndon Baines Johnson? At Graceland, Presley added a 3-television console like the one LBJ had in the Oval Office. The King also hung in his home an All the Way with LBJ bumper sticker from the 1964 presidential campaign and posed for a publicity photo with the president's daughter, Linda Bird Johnson, who at the time was dating the actor George Hamilton. Presley and Johnson at first seemed to be the oddest of couples, but they had more in common than their separate celebrity worlds would suggest. Both became national figures who challenged, whose very lives disrupted, the historically toxic characterization of poor whites. When Elvis stormed onto the national scene in 1956, he seemed to be doing everything he could to act non-white. He openly embraced black musical style, black pompadour hair, and flashy outfits that had been associated with blacks as well. His gyrations caused his critics to compare his wildly sexualized dancing to the hoochie coochie, or burlesque striptease, and the rebellious zoot suit crowd. His phenomenal fame and adoring fans helped to propel him to the Ed Sullivan Show, and from there to the silver screen. He soon owned a stable of Cadillacs. Elvis had achieved what no white trash working class male had ever dreamt possible. He was at once cool and sexually transgressive and a country boy. No longer a freakish rural outcast as in the past, Elvis was a hillbilly cat, someone many teenage boys wished they could be. Lyndon Johnson's sudden elevation to the office of chief executive on November 22, 1963, came as a great shock to the nation. Eerily replaying what had happened a century earlier, a second unelected Johnson entered the presidency after a shocking assassination. But this time, instead of the sorrow-laden, war-weary Lincoln, the nation had lost the vigorous, photogenic East Coast elite John F. Kennedy. In the wake of tragedy, the seasoned Southern politician pursued an aggressive legislative agenda in favor of civil rights and social reform, the most dramatic foray since FDR. The Great Society, as his vast array of programs became known, called for the elimination of poll taxes and voting discrimination, the promotion of education and health care funding, and daring new programs in an effort to eradicate poverty. Yet what made LBJ different from his Democratic predecessor was the necessity that he reinvent himself by shedding the predictable trappings of a Southern backwater identity, which he did without unlearning his famous Texas drawl. The accidental president had to transform how he was perceived on television, how he was judged by Washington reporters, how he was received as a national leader. Though Johnson had a proven record as a New Dealer and modern progressive, on the national stage he was still regarded as a regional figure. He refused to go easy on white rule in the South. In his 1965 inaugural address, he made progressive change a matter of national survival. He wanted to use his powers to work toward broad social equality. In many ways, Johnson's insistence on change echoed what the sociologist Howard Odom had prescribed in earlier decades. Southerners had to free themselves from their misplaced nostalgia for the old Confederacy. He wasn't afraid of modernity. "I do not believe that the Great Society is the ordered, changeless, and sterile battalion of ants," Johnson put it bluntly upon inauguration in 1965. Mindless conformity, whether Soviet or Southern in style, was stifling and repressive. His heroes had not been Andrew Johnson or James K. Vardaman. Franklin Roosevelt was the politician he most admired. During the Depression, Johnson was a strong proponent of rural electrification, and he ran the Jobs Corps program, the National Youth Administration, in Texas. He had no patience for country bumpkin antics either. LBJ loved modern technology, campaigned across Texas by prop plane before World War II, and was the first to use a helicopter in his Senate campaign of 1948. That year, winning in a close race, he presented himself as a worldly politician, jettisoning the folksy style of his opponent, whom a Johnson aide described as old hat, old ways, old everything. As majority leader of the Senate and during his vice presidency as chairman of the National Aeronautics and Space Council, it was Lyndon Johnson who first promoted stepping into the space race and making it a national priority to put a man on the moon. There were no red suspenders in this Southern boy's closet, no blustering race baiting to mark his career. The public had no difficulty understanding the high moral tone of LBJ's presidential oratory. He despised the false rhetoric of those Dixiecrats who feigned class solidarity with poor whites, rhetoric that typically involved angry appeals to white supremacy. As president, when he advocated civil rights, Lyndon Johnson spoke the language of brotherly love and inclusiveness. In spite of all this, the old country boy image still haunted him. Presumably by coincidence, as President Johnson stood tall under the glare of the national spotlight, TV network executives discovered the hick sitcom. Three of the most popular shows in the 1960s were The Andy Griffith Show, Gomer Pyle, USMC, and The Beverly Hillbillies. All revived the homespun, albeit unassimilable, traits of good old Shug, the rural pole of the 1840s. Lyndon Johnson fondly remembered Roosevelt as a daddy to me, and as town sheriff, Andy Griffith served as the paternal caretaker of Mayberry, North Carolina. The Andy Griffith Show had the feel of the 30s, not the 60s. It was a nostalgic rewrite of the Great Depression, featuring a town of misfits. Speaking about his role, Griffith insisted that he was not playing a yokel. The creator of the show described the sheriff as a clever man with a wry sense of humor, on the order of the late Will Rogers, the good-natured Oklahoma humorist and film hero. As for Mayberry, most problems were solved around Andy's kitchen table, reminiscent of how Americans huddled around the radio, listening to FDR's fireside chats. Outsiders were welcome in Andy's world, where the virtues of small-town democracy shone. Though the actor stopped short of saying it, Sheriff Andy was indeed surrounded by yokels because television traded on the worst stereotypes. Mayberry's population included the gullible gas station attendant Gomer Pyle, before he got his own show, and his cousin Goober, and Ernest T. Bass, a screeching mountaineer who went on wild rampages. As a writer for Time noted of Jim Nabors's Gomer, the naive enlistee spouts homilies out of a lopsided mouth and lopes around uncertainly like a plowboy stepping through a field of cow dung. He is a walking disaster who, in his subsequent spin-off show, single-handedly fouls up the bureaucracy of the entire Marine Corps. With the Clampets of Beverly Hills, as the comedian Bob Hope joked, Americans had their embodiment of TV wasteland, a wasteland with an outhouse. Episode after episode, Granny and her kin were stymied by the science of the doorbell and the unbearable complexity of kitchen appliances, giving viewers the saddest sort of reminder of the culture shock experienced by real sharecroppers in FSA resettlement communities. Buddy Ebsen's primetime hillbillies appeared on the cover of the Saturday Evening Post, sketched as characters in Grant Wood's iconic painting of 1930, American Gothic. This was yet another unsubtle allusion to the long-held belief that white trash were an evolutionary throwback. The Beverly Hillbillies had its defenders, To the creator of the show, our hillbillies were clean and wholesome, and the network was actually doing a service in uplifting the image of rural Americans. The word hillbilly, he insisted, will ultimately have a new meaning in the United States as a result of our show. His optimism proved to be misplaced. Jed Clampett was no Davy Crockett, even though Buddy Ebsen had, in fact, played the gruff sidekick to Fess Parker's coon-capped Crockett in the 50s Disney saga. The differences between Jed and Davy were stark. Hollywood hillbillies could only be crude objects of audience laughter, mockery, not admiration. They conjured none of the frontier fantasy of the rugged individualist Crockett or Fess Parker's TV Daniel Boone. Nothing could redeem them. The Clampetts drove a 1920s-era Ford jalopy, and Granny sat on board in a rocking chair, a camp version of John Ford's desperate Joad family. Fess Parker's buckskin champion was a jaunty country boy, a genial Gary Cooper-style suburban dad. All viewers understood that Parker's Crockett represented the best qualities imagined of early America. The 1955 Davy Crockett phase caused adoring fans to mob the actor in a way that momentarily put him in a league with Elvis. Coonskin caps flew off store shelves as Disney Studios staged a publicity tour. Parker, a towering Texan, even made a stop on Capitol Hill. In a photograph distributed over the wire services, then-Senator Lyndon Johnson and Speaker of the House Sam Rayburn struck up a pose with Davy and his rifle, Ol' Betsy. Their signature laugh track aside, 60s comedies were not purely escapist fare. They tapped into a larger anxiety amid the mass migration of poor whites who headed north and created hillbilly ghettos in cities such as Baltimore, St. Louis, Detroit, Chicago, and Cincinnati, which only fueled existing prejudice against briar hoppers, recalling the nomenclature of an Odom respondent. Writing about poor whites in Chicago in 1968, the syndicated columnist Paul Harvey drew a practical connection for his readers. Suppose a real-life likeness of TV's Beverly Hillbillies should move to the big city without those millions of dollars in the bank. The trio of sitcoms tapped into suspicions that modern America had failed to create a genuine melting pot. The cultural distance between rural and urban life, between rich and poor, was immense. Don Knotts's slapstick character Barney Fife, Sheriff Andy's bumbling cousin, didn't belong in the big city any more than the corn cracker of Davy Crockett's Almanac of 1837 did in the 1830s. Despite his drill sergeant's unrelenting badgering, Gomer, the hapless private, failed to conform to military culture. He wasn't fit for the Marines, let alone for white-collar corporate America. And the Clampetts may have bought a mansion in the heart of Hollywood, but they had not moved even one rung on the social ladder. They didn't even try to behave like middle-class Americans. Hal Humphrey of the Los Angeles Times observed in 1963 that the joy of watching the Beverly Hillbillies was linked to the fact that most Americans are extremely class-conscious. No matter what the plot line, every episode pitted the mercenary banker Milburn Drysdale, his social-climbing wife and boob of a son, a young man of questionable virility, against the low-down Clampetts. In Humphrey's opinion, the Joe Dokeses, or average viewers, got to see a bunch of ragged hill people who were obviously inferior, outsmarting equally undeserving big shots. Theirs was, in short, a contest between snobs and slobs. As far as the critic was concerned, the show's creator had come up with a formula that camouflaged class conflict with laughs. Finally, he joked, the class-bashing TV series cashes in on Groucho Marx's theory of class struggle. Or was that Karl Marx? In the face of social upheaval, as so many old boundaries and prejudices shifted, Americans generally denied what they remained, highly class-conscious. The interconnected civil rights movement and culture wars of the 50s and 60s were marked by social stratification. As ownership of a home in the suburbs came to represent the American dream, the most controversial housing option was, significantly, the trailer park. Segregation, then, was more than simply a racial issue. Zoning laws made it inevitable that housing would adhere to a class-delineated geography. The working class had its bowling alleys and diners, and white trash its trailer park slums, both of which contrasted sharply with the backyard barbecues of all-white neighborhoods in favored suburbs, zoned for the middle class. We forget that President Johnson's Great Society programs targeted both urban ghettos and impoverished white areas of Appalachia. Vietnam has been referred to as the Living Room War, yet on their black-and-white television sets in 1957, Americans had already watched a racial and class war as angry poor whites screamed curses at well-mannered black students as they tried to enter Little Rock's Central High School. It is for reasons such as these that the poor country boy Elvis symbolized a lot of things for the generation that came of age in the 50s. While whitening African-American music and challenging conservative sexual mores, he retained a social identity that was close to the storyline of the Beverly Hillbillies. Here was a son of a white sharecropper suddenly catapulted to a place of wealth and fame. He purchased Graceland, a mansion outside of Memphis where he lived with his parents. For his beloved mother, he bought a pink Cadillac, and to make the house truly a home she could appreciate, he built her a chicken coop in the backyard. As Elvis became the country squire of Graceland, middle-class Americans found themselves promoting the merits of suburbia more generally. Vice President Richard Nixon, for one, saw the expanding housing market as a powerful tool in waging Cold War diplomacy. In 1959, the world's two superpowers agreed to a cultural exchange. The Soviets prepared an exhibit on Sputnik and space exploration, which was put on display in New York City. For its part, the United States chose an earthbound emblem of its national pride, a typical ranch-style home, which was set up in Sokolniki Park for the edification of Russian crowds. Speaking at the opening ceremony in Moscow, Nixon took stock of the 31 million American families that owned homes, the 44 million citizens who drove 56 million cars, and the 50 million who watched their own television sets. At this opportunistic moment, the vice president did his best to wear multiple hats, sounding on the one hand like a Madison Avenue ad man, and on the other as a prophet of the new middle class. Either way, he explicitly denied being representative of a shallow materialism. The real wonder of America's achievement, he professed, was that the world's largest capitalist country had come closest to the ideal of prosperity for all in a classless society. These words strike at the heart of the matter. For Nixon, the United States was more than a land of plenty. Democratic in its collective soul, it had nearly achieved a kind of utopia. For the first time in history, capitalism was not the engine of greed, aimed at monopolizing wealth and resources. Free enterprise in the 1950s was a magic elixir that was succeeding in erasing class lines, especially through home ownership, or so he wanted it understood. The Nixons sold themselves as the perfect suburban family. Not long before his Moscow trip, the vice president and his family took a trip to Disneyland, which made the front pages. During the 1960 campaign, when Nixon contested John F. Kennedy for the presidency, it was Pat Nixon who praised her husband, and included herself, as the personification of the American dream. In anticipation of her husband's nomination, she told reporters that their success embodied the promise of the post-war generation, where people of humble circumstances can go up the ladder through sheer hard work and obtain what they work for. If she happened to become First Lady, she said, she would be the first working girl ever to inhabit the White House. Republican marketeers used Pat aggressively, producing tons of campaign materials that included badges, flags, brochures, combs, jewelry, and a variety of buttons, all of which boosted Pat as the ideal suburban homemaker. Party organizers stormed the barricades of suburban shopping centers with Patmobiles and Pat parades. Unlike a stunning young Jacqueline Bouvier Kennedy decked out in French couture, Pat Nixon picked her clothes off the store racks and chose those items she could easily pack. The Nixons hailed from Whittier in Southern California, an area of the Sun Belt that underwent dramatic changes from 1946 to 1970. As millions of Americans bought new homes, suburban enclaves arose in the orbit of metropolitan Los Angeles, Phoenix, Houston, Miami, and elsewhere. One of the best publicized housing developments of the era grew in Levittown, on the outskirts of New York City. The Levitts thought big, putting up 17,400 houses and attracting 82,000 residents to their Long Island development. This sweeping success led them to construct two massive subdivisions in Bucks County, Pennsylvania, and Willingboro, New Jersey. As skilled promoters, the Levitts did more than simply build homes. Like their earliest progenitor, Richard Hakluyt of Old Elizabethan England, they were planting self-sustaining colonies in the hinterland. The Levitts imagined suburbs as middle-class consumer outposts, geared for leisure activities. Baseball fields, bicycle pathways, and swimming pools complemented commercially zoned areas for shopping centers. The key to the Levitt system was not just cheaper housing, but homogeneous populations. In their phrasing, stabilized neighborhoods. They meant racial and class homogeneity, which led them to endorse restrictive covenants prohibiting owners from selling their homes to black families. The Levitts knew the South because their first large-scale project was an all-white facility for wartime workers in Norfolk, Virginia. By planting suburbs in quasi-rural areas, the Levitts recognized that the value of land was not determined by industry or commerce. As isolated outposts, land values were tied to the class status of the occupants. Buying a home here required the male breadwinner to have a steady income, a mark of the new 50s middle class. Levittown was dubbed a garden community, but the new style of tract homes uneasily occupied this rustic space. During the 50s, the pastoral image of suburbs was applied to all kinds of bedroom communities. Popular magazines featured wives tending their gardens, husbands grilling at their barbecues. This was a fanciful recasting of the Jeffersonian ideal. Suburbanites were the new, let us say, backyard yeomanry. To add to the Jeffersonian call for exurban procreative strength, the new suburbs acquired unsubtle nicknames like Fertile Acres, owing to the high birth rates in young families. Yet many critics saw uniform homes and neat lawns as hollow symbols, a far cry from genuine democratic virtues. Instead of eliminating class distinctions, suburbs were turned into class-conscious fortresses. Zoning ordinances set lot sizes and restricted the construction of apartment buildings, emphasizing single-dwelling homes to keep out undesirable lower-class families. In Mahwah, New Jersey, for example, the local government attracted a Ford plant to the town and then passed an ordinance that required one-acre lots containing homes in the $20,000 price range, ostensibly meaning that low-paid workers in the plant would have to live elsewhere. In New York's Westchester County, the Board of Education agreed to build a deluxe school in a wealthy neighborhood while doing nothing for schools in depressed income areas where lower-class Italian and black families lived. In Los Angeles, suburbs were appraised by the Federal Housing Authority along class lines. High marks were given to places where gardening was a popular hobby, and low marks to places where poor whites raised food in their backyards. Elvis's mother's chicken coop would have been frowned upon. In this and other ways, the federal government underwrote the growth of the new suburban frontier. Tax laws gave homeowners who took out mortgages an attractive deduction. Government made it profitable for banks to grant mortgages to upstanding veterans and to men with steady jobs. The Servicemen's Readjustment Act of 1944, better known as the GI Bill, created the Veterans Administration, which oversaw the ex-soldiers' mortgage program. Together, the FHA and the VA worked to provide generous terms. Uncle Sam insured as much as 90% of the typical veteran's mortgage, thereby encouraging lenders to provide low interest rates and low monthly payments. Along these same lines, when potential buyers queued up for Levittown homes, the builder initially privileged veterans. With such perks, it became cheaper for desirable white men to buy a home than to rent an apartment. And rather than lift up everyone, the system tended to favor those who were already middle class or those working class families with steady incomes. Suburban subdivisions encouraged buyers to live with their own kind, constantly sorting people by religion, ethnicity, race, and class. The esteemed architectural critic Lewis Mumford described Levittown as a one-class community. In 1959, the best-selling author and journalist Vance Packard summed up the suburban filtration process as birds of a feather flocking. As we have so often seen, the importance of animal stock and of breed generally remained on the tip of the American tongue when idiomatic distinctions of class identity were being made. In 1951, the Levitts opened their second development in Bucks County, Pennsylvania, after U.S. Steel decided to build its Fairless Works in the area. It attracted steel workers as well as a community of construction workers who established a trailer camp. Although little actually separated the two working class communities, the families were stable and had about the same number of children, the Levittowners felt that their community was a symbol of middle class attainment, while the camp's residents were labeled trailer trash. To expel the trailer families, local officials quickly passed ordinances. Offended local residents dismissed the trailer families as transients, saying that they should be gotten rid of as soon as possible. One of the arguments marshaled against the trailer enclave will sound familiar: the preservation of property values. The construction workers were deemed trash not because of their class background per se, but because they lived in trailers. It was their homes on wheels that carried the stigma. The trailer occupies an important, if uncertain, place in the American cultural imagination. Representing, on the one hand, a symbol of untethered freedom, the mobile home simultaneously acquired its reputation as a tin can, a small, cheap, confined way of life. When you live in a trailer, you are literally rootless, and privacy disappears. Neighbors see and hear. At their worst, such places have been associated with liberty's dark side, deviant, dystopian wastelands set on the fringe of the metropolis. Trailers had been controversial since the 1930s. Aside from the sleek, streamlined capsules that traverse the open road, these rickety boxes tend to be viewed as eyesores. Almost as soon as they were turned into permanent housing, many were associated with slums built on town dumps. As an object, the trailer is something modern and anti-modern, chic and gauche, liberating and suffocating. Unlike the dull but safe middle American suburb, trailer parks contain folks who appear on the way out, not up. Retired persons, migrant workers, and the troubled poor. This remains true today. Prior to World War II, the first generation of trailers were jerry-rigged contraptions built in backyards, expressly used on hunting and fishing trips. When they hit the road in the 30s, right when Okies took to their jalopies along Route 66, one journalist called them monstrosities, shanties on wheels. War changed that. Faced with a severe housing shortage, the federal government purchased trailers for soldiers, sailors, and defense workers. As many as 35,000 trailers were drummed into service. And because military and defense installations were everywhere, trailer towns suddenly popped up in unexpected places, from Maine to Michigan to Texas. In places like Hartford, Connecticut, defense workers living in trailer villages were easily compared to colonists and gypsies. The most remarkable account of trailer camps formed in defense centers came from the talented reporter Agnes Meyer of The Washington Post. Her dispatches as a war correspondent on the home front, as she called herself, were compiled and published as a book entitled Journey Through Chaos. Well-bred American women were not supposed to see chaos up close. Indeed, though her family considered higher education inappropriate for a young female, Meyer graduated from Barnard College, studied at the Sorbonne, published a scholarly work on Chinese painting, and became the first woman hired by the New York Sun. Momentously, she went on to marry a multimillionaire who decided to purchase the floundering Washington Post. Their daughter, Catherine Meyer Graham, grew up to be the most influential editor of the family's paper. In 1943, Agnes Meyer was on a fact-finding expedition when she traveled to 27 war centers, from Buffalo to Detroit and all the way out to Puget Sound, Washington, south to California, and back east by way of Texas, Louisiana, Mississippi, and Florida. She described the people she saw with unsparing detail. Her most disturbing encounters occurred, not surprisingly, in the Deep South. She shone a light on the rows of tents, trailers, and run-down shacks in Pascagoula, Mississippi, and Mobile, Alabama. She bemoaned the neglected rural areas and called the white trash who migrated from there pitiful, ragged, illiterate, and undernourished. They had refused to move into respectable housing projects out of fear of the law, but mostly, Meyer believed, because they feared the restraint of being members of a decent community. Overwhelmed by the condition of their lives, by their physical and mental health and lack of prospects, she asked incredulously, "Is this America?" It was the shipyards that brought workers to Pascagoula. Nearly 5,000 new workers and their families crowded the small town on the Gulf of Mexico, quickly unleashing a panic among local residents. Many of the workers were backwoods people, and their trailers were quite unsanitary. Meyer met a 51-year-old man who looked 80, a clear throwback to the 1840s, when clay eaters were identified in the same way, old before their time. Townspeople denounced them as vermin. The manager of the shipyards told the weary female reporter that unless these people were lifted up, they will pull the rest of the nation down. On to Mobile, where she learned that the illegitimacy rate was high and getting higher, and that a black market trade in babies existed. By the time she reached Florida, she found the poor whites to be handsome on approach, but strange-looking as soon as they smiled and exposed sets of decaying teeth. Still, they were less repulsive to her than the subnormal swamp and mountain folk she had already encountered in Mississippi and Alabama. It was the Southern war camps that set the tone, but after the war, trailer trash became a generic term, no longer regionally specific. They appeared on the outskirts of Pittsburgh and Flint, Michigan, as well as in North Carolina and parts of the Upper South. In far-off Arizona, trailer trash doubled as squatters, photographed in weedy areas and without houses in their front yards. To be displaced and poor was to be white trash. Responding to bad publicity, trailer manufacturers launched a campaign to dramatically change their image. By 1947, they were calling their product a trailer coach, emphasizing more attractive, more convenient interiors so as to woo the feminine trade. The determined Trailer Manufacturers Association pressed for improved trailer parks, an image that conjured well-manicured, family-friendly garden sites and was meant to cast off the temporary-sounding, refugee-bearing trailer camps of World War II. In sum, to make the mobile home more acceptable, manufacturers had to domesticate it. These sharp, socially attuned promoters worked hard to reinvent the trailer as a miniature suburban bungalow on wheels. They did everything they could to remove trailer trash from the American vocabulary. It proved difficult for the trailer to compete with the tract house. Potential buyers were placed at an economic disadvantage. The FHA did not get around to insuring mortgages for mobile homes until 1971. So until then, even though trailers were cheaper, owners faced other hidden costs and penalties. Trailer parks were exiled to the least desirable lots, a sorry distance from the nicer, better-protected residential areas. Many park managers forbade children and pets, the two most obvious attractions for young couples living in suburbia. More parks emerged with smaller lots, tiny lawns, or no lawns at all. In many cities and counties, even retirees found their welcome worn out, resented because they lived on tight budgets, contributed too little to commercial growth, and failed to pay property taxes. Hollywood captured the uneasy fit between suburban ideals and life on the road in a farcical film of 1954, The Long, Long Trailer, which starred Lucille Ball and Desi Arnaz. The couple suffered mishap after mishap as they proved that mobile homes undermined privacy in general and sex life in particular, not to mention providing inadequate space for the husband's treasured golf clubs. The scene that makes the mobile home problem most disconcerting occurs when the 10-foot-wide trailer flattens a relative's rose bushes, ruins her yard, and upends what began as a lovely home in a quaint neighborhood. Trailers were shown to be hazards and nuisances, out of place in the suburban dream landscape. As trailer living became increasingly popular, opposition grew apace. In the late 50s, more mobile homes were built than prefabricated homes, yet municipalities continued to look down on them. In 1962, in an important New Jersey court case, the majority ruled that a rural township could prohibit trailer parks within its limits. Still, the judge who wrote the dissent exposed the dangerous implications of this decision. Trailer dwellers had become a class of people, he explained, through which discrimination was tolerated under the vague language of protecting the general welfare. For at least this one jurist, inherited social biases had reduced the owners of mobile homes to footloose nomadic people, a group of migratory paupers. Retailers and real estate agents once again sought to change public perceptions. Since they could not effectively regulate the quality of mobile home parks in general, they decided to add an upscale version and turned to advertising more exclusive mobile home communities. To separate the dumpy and dirty trailer slums from five-star dwellings, they rebranded the upscale sites as resorts. Trailer park became a dirty word. Exchanging his coonskin cap for a realtor's jacket, the actor Fess Parker became an investor in and leading promoter of high-end trailer playgrounds. Carefree living, Parker boasted, coining a new motto for a new class. In the hands of Sunbelt speculators working hard to attract a lucrative clientele, trailer life was meant to invite comparisons to luxury hotels. Fess Parker's resort in Santa Barbara offered ocean views, a golf course, and a stock market ticker tape. Davy Crockett's Call of the Wild did not completely disappear either. Trailer life updated the once catchy cry of the open road by declaring freedom from the 30-year mortgage. In 1957, drawing on a Playboy motif, a writer for Trailer Topics magazine promised a well-earned respite from the well-harnessed suburban life. The story was accompanied by a photograph of a sexy blonde sitting coquettishly on a trailer couch. Other mobile home dealers promised residents freedom from the suburban rut and the tedious routine of playing nursemaid to lawns, patios, and plumbing. In Richard Nixon's birthplace of Yorba Linda, California, what was called primordial Nixon country, a remarkable trailer community went up. Nixon country meant Republican, conservative, and deeply class conscious. Lake Park offered a country club style of living, replete with man-made lake, swimming pool, landscaped greenery, and gently winding streets. To a New York Times reporter, it was suburbia in miniature. The developers, two men from Los Angeles, spent 3 years trying to find a city hall in Orange County that would allow them to build and were repeatedly turned down. In order to convince Yorba Linda officials that it was not their intent to impinge upon the class consciousness of existing residents, they recast the prospective community as a private club, highlighting the beautiful environment and ensuring that residents would pay added expenses to maintain their lots. When that was not enough, the developers added one final touch, a 5-foot-high wall around the entire complex. As one city administrator observed, "We don't even know they're there." Another local resident, without any apparent shame, admitted, "We call them the people inside the wall, and we're the people outside the wall." Was there any better symbol of an undisguised belief in class stratification than the construction of a wall? But the Yorba Linda trailer community hardly fit the typical profile. Further down the scale, of course, were the many low-down trailer parks that dotted the map of America. By 1968, only 13% of mobile homeowners held white-collar jobs, and a sizable percentage of those who lived in the poorer trailer parks came from rural, mainly southern, areas. Families that could not afford to buy a new trailer were buying or renting depreciated, that is, second-hand, possibly third-hand, trailers. A new used market emerged, fueling what two sociologists called hillbilly havens that cropped up on the periphery of cities in the Sun Belt, the Midwest, and elsewhere. Scattered along highways, often near the railroad tracks, run-down trailer parks were barely distinguishable from junkyards. Trailer trash had become America's untouchables. To make matters worse, poor and working-class trailer communities were believed to be dens of iniquity. The charge actually went back to World War II defense centers, to which prostitutes migrated in a scattering of whorehouses on wheels. By the 50s, pulp fiction, with such titles as Trailer Tramp and The Trailer Park Girls, told stories of casual sexual encounters and voyeurism. In the parlance of the day, the female trailer tramp moved from town to town, from man to man. Alongside such tales was Cracker Girl, 1953, soft porn pulp that titillated readers and capitalized on the thrill of crossing the tracks and getting sex on the low down. Tramps and trailer nomadism, like drugs and gambling, identified social disorder on the edge of town. The poor dominated the mobile home picture. In 1969, the 13 Appalachian states were on the receiving end of 40% of mobile home shipments, and, not surprisingly, the cheapest models, under $5,000, headed for the hills. In 1971, New York City approved its first trailer park after Mayor John Lindsay found support for a policy of housing the homeless in trailers. These were not Bowery bums, but people who were being uprooted as a result of urban renewal. Yet somehow the solution was to stow them away in a most non-urban sort of accommodation. From Appalachia to the Big Apple, then, those without economic security and with the least political clout were seen as the most likely candidates for the trailer park. Cheap land, a plot of concrete and mud, and a junkyard trailer, the updated squatter's hovel, became the measure of white trash identity. By the 1960s, class was deeply imprinted onto most residential landscapes through zoning, housing, and school funding. As rural Southerners relocated to metropolitan areas in search of work, a new kind of class tribalism emerged. Poor whites fought for a shrinking territory, and class conflict was played out in residential spaces. Which brings us to Hazel Bryan and the crystallization of the modern media circus.